Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Ohio State University has resumed its regular class schedule today. The university shut down on Monday after a student plowed a car into a group of other students and staff on campus and then turned on others with a butcher knife. The incident lasted fewer than 60 seconds, and even after the attacker was shot and killed by a campus police officer, students and staff hid and waited for more than an hour. The morning kicked off with a reported gas leak in a campus building, forcing the evacuation of students and staff. At 9:52 a.m., a man since identified as Abdul Razak Ali Artan drove the car over a curb and into the group. Several bystanders called for emergency help.
911, where's your emergency?
Yes, Watts Hall on OSU's campus. Somebody just drove through a crowd full of people. He's not firing a gun. Or I don't know who's firing a gun. Looks like a campus police officer.
Okay.
He just drove through. We need an ambulance here fast, please. There's a guy hit. He's on the ground. There's another person
on
the ground.
Hold on.
This hour, we're going to talk about what's next, what we know academically about such attacks, and how to deal with the trauma. Joining us now by phone is Columbus Police Chief Kim Jacobs. Welcome back to the show, Chief.
Good morning.
What's your first step after such an incident?
Well, to make sure that we secure the scene so that we can get to anybody that's injured and get them the help that they need, and then determine whether or not we have other suspects out there, which is part of why a campus was locked down for so long yesterday. But we want to make sure that we get the scene secured as quickly as possible so we can get aid to the injured people.
How do you suss out a motive in such a situation?
Well, certainly we're going to look at what people have said, either verbally or in writing, online, to determine if they had a justification in their own mind for harming people. What might have been behind it, because we want to know whether or not that person was working with someone else. And by determining that, we can try to answer the question of, is there something we could do to prevent such future attacks?
Have you absolutely ruled out any kind of accomplice in this case?
I wouldn't say that. We don't have enough information at this point in time. You know, everybody has a lot of people in their life, and we need to talk to people that knew him and find out what they knew about him. You know, were there any signs? Were there any people that he worked with, cooperated with, or perhaps influenced by?
NBC News has reported that Abdul Artan posted a rant or a statement on Facebook. We haven't been able to find that ourselves, but what do you know about that?
Well, I've seen the same thing. I believe that it discusses his feelings about the current status of his faith and some of his troubles. And certainly that will be looked at and kind of gone over, poured over to determine whether or not there was a basis there for his actions.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the aftermath, and the attack yesterday on the OSU campus. Classes have resumed today. My guest right now, Chief Columbus Division of Police Chief Kim Jacobs, is with us. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call. We'll pick it up later in the program, 614-292-8513. How did the OSU community respond, in your opinion?
I believe that everybody did exactly what we would hope for, and that is to get aid. You know, you heard the 911 call that, you know, get somebody here to help this injured person and other persons. They reported that there were shots fired. We need information. It just pours in. 911 just lights up when something like that happens. So we need information. We need people to give us updates on what we don't already know. So sometimes we, you know, very quickly say, okay, I already know that, but let me know what else you might see or who you might have seen, and descriptions of vehicles and other suspicious activity. So we got information quickly and lots of reports, which is good. And then they also were evacuating and fleeing and hiding and sheltering in place and not standing around gawking and being a part of a scene that really needed to have safety personnel taking over.
You know, you've been in the business for a long time, and I interviewed a student yesterday who, while they were sheltering in place. And I also heard the same thing you just heard from the caller to 911. It sounds like people are getting pretty sophisticated about how they report such crimes.
And that's a good thing. Unfortunately, you know, whether it's a accident or violence that occurs, we need information to be able to help people as quickly as possible. So we appreciate the fact that people have, you know, mobile phones and are able to get us that information as soon as possible. And then to be able to describe what it is that we need to know, you know, descriptions of people, what their clothing was, what their vehicles were, direction of travel, where we need to be, you know, as far as a scene, all of that enables us to get the type of help to that place quickly.
The fire alarm that went off before the attack and the attack itself were not connected, or at least that's what's being reported. How do we know that?
Well, I hazard to say that we don't know for sure.
Okay.
But I believe at this point in time that we've got some information that, that tells us that, no, it was kind of a actual fortunate coincidence in the sense that it put the OSU officer there close to the scene and was able to deal with the suspect very quickly. Maybe unfortunate because I'm not sure if some of those people that were injured were outside because of the alarm.
Uh-huh.
But right now we don't have good reason to believe that they were connected.
And the officer that responded felled the attacker, shooting him, killing him, that's what you would recommend in such a case?
Well, we want to be as quickly as possible to wherever the danger is. And, you know, we want the officer to take the appropriate action, whatever that might be. You know, if he can apprehend the person without force, that's always our goal. But, you know, if somebody presents a threat to the responding officers, then the officer has the right to defend themselves and or others. And I believe that that threat was still occurring with the suspect holding the large knife that he was.
Right. Homeland Security is now involved in the investigation. Why are they involved? What are they looking for?
To determine whether or not there are any co-conspirators, determine whether or not there are indications that could have given us an idea of a possible attack along these lines. You know, one of the things we try to learn from all of these situations is, was there something that we missed or could have known to alert us to a situation like that? And our federal partners help us in identifying threats of that nature.
How do you parse, then, a garden variety attack from a terrorist attack? Is that what you're saying that Homeland Security is involved in?
They get involved, certainly, when we think that there might be some type of a terrorism-related ideology that is causing this type of a violent act to occur.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, all of these situations, anytime somebody wants to harm another, is of importance to us. And, you know, doesn't take a certain ideology to hurt people. Some people just, you know, have that bad intent or maybe, you know, aren't stable enough to be able to deal with whatever's going on and attack others.
I heard an interview with an OSU student this morning who is Muslim. He said he would go to classes today, but that he was wary. And I wondered to what extent you are concerned about the safety of other Muslims on campus and elsewhere who could be victimized because of this incident.
I tell people all the time that we can't help others if they don't tell us what's going on. So I believe it's important that if people are actually you know, harmed or threatened in some way by others for whatever reason, that they need to let us know so that we can at least try to talk to whoever might have done that or give them the information that they might need to either file charges or get some type of mediation set up. And that's especially on campus, telling the OSU officials as well that they need to know what is going on their campus, just like we do in the city. But you know, if that's happening, we need to know about it so that we can address it. I ask them to make reports, to call us, and to, you know, give us an opportunity to check into it.
Have you received any kind of uptick in reporting on people being harassed or threatened because of their, you know, what they look like or what they're wearing?
I certainly know that people have those fears. Mm-hmm. I can't say that the incident level has necessarily risen, mm-hmm. but I do know that the fear is there, much like the fear in the community after the Pulse nightclub incident. You know, fear is a part of this whole idea of terror. And so we don't want people to live in fear. We don't want them to be afraid to walk down the street. We want them to go about their business free of harm, free of threats, free of fear. So we need them to let us know if something actually does occur to them, what it was and who we need to talk to about it.
Are you concerned at all? I suppose it kind of feeds into the whole idea, but the idea of copycats or anything like that.
We worry about that on a regular basis. You know, when we talk about active shooters or mass casualties across the country, who knows if somebody is the next person that wants their name in the paper for, you know, half a day or something like that. And, you know, there's enough people out there that are either influenced or unstable enough to think that that's a good way of getting attention. So we're always worried about that, but we encourage anybody that is familiar with a person that thinks along those lines to let us know so that we can do a little background on them to find out if they're actually up to something.
The attacker did not have a gun. He had a big knife. At first was described as a machete, later a big butcher knife. But he wasn't an active shooter, and OSU was reporting and alerting people to an active shooter on campus. They didn't know that. How do you feel about that? Some people feel it wasn't very fair to do that. That it once again casts people who use guns, gun owners, in a negative light.
That scene was extremely chaotic. It all happened so fast, and gunshots were heard, obviously, by gunshots by the officers. So I really don't complain when people give us information, even if it's erroneous, based on what they're hearing or seeing or thinking. It gives us an opportunity to check that out. And if knowing that an active shooter or just hearing shots causes people to secure themselves and run or go take shelter, then I believe that's probably a good thing. It gets them away from wherever that danger might be and gives us more information to follow up on. That's sometimes what slows us down. You know, we had some backpacks that were dropped. We had, you know, people seeing others running and fleeing and had to follow up on whether or not they were connected to the suspect or not. But we would rather check it all out and allow people to be able to rest assured that we've done everything we can to check all the information out rather than have a lack of information.
Chief, thanks so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Absolutely.
That's Columbus Division of Police Chief Kim Jacobs. We'll continue our conversation. We're going to be talking about the trauma, the lingering trauma of such an event, and also what can trigger these kinds of things and what we know about these kinds of attacks. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking today about the attack on the Ohio State campus Monday. Classes have resumed today, but experts say that depending on the individual, the related trauma could linger. Such an attack on a college campus, of course, is not new. Most, however, involve guns. The April 2007 incident at Virginia Tech is the deadliest shooting rampage in U.S. history in which one shooter killed 32 people. Since then, colleges and universities have improved how they respond in the moment, and our previous guest, Columbus Chief of Police Kim Jacobs, gave OSU high marks in that regard. But lingering psychological trauma remains a threat. Dr. J. Barry Mascari is a certified disaster response crisis counselor and co-editor of the American Counseling Association guide entitled Terrorism, Trauma, and Tragedies, a counselor's guide to preparing and responding. He joins us by phone from New Jersey. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Who can feel the effects of trauma in a situation such as this? What's the, you know, the universe there?
Well, the most important thing to remember is that after any disaster, and this qualifies as a disaster, maybe on a smaller scale in terms of scope, but the first 48 hours are critical. And what people experience, the vast majority of people, are normal reactions to an abnormal event. And what? After those 48 hours, most don't have any lingering effects.
So for most, it's that first 48 hours. And let's start there. What are the red flags during that period of time?
Well, most people show some sort of upset, especially if they were witnesses or in the area. And then others, you know, they've watched the news. In fact, after 9/11, one of the things we did with kids in school was to make sure the TVs were turned off so that they didn't continue to re-traumatize themselves by watching it. So the disaster response crisis counselors, you probably know that FEMA has a preferred modality, and that's psychological first aid, similar to the first aid kit that you have at home or in your car. You're putting Band-Aids on people, not because they need major help, but they need to be able to get through this immediate injury. And so a lot of times, just being a compassionate presence is enough to help people through the immediate situation.
How does the 24-hour news cycle impact how we cope with the stress? You made the point that, yeah, we turned off the televisions for the youngsters after 9/11. I had one myself at the time. Yeah. But what about the rest of us?
I know. You can see news now more than you ever could before. You're seeing live feeds. And so, yeah, it potentially can be upsetting, so that we encourage people to do a couple of things. And certainly, when somebody responds after this event with the people in the immediate vicinity, three things that they're taught to do, and that is protect, direct, and connect. Protect them from exposure to media, other kinds of negative things, and obviously, the situation was secured rather rapidly. But then directing them toward other kinds of services, maybe immediate service in the area, or finally, connecting them with either their family, their community, other services. We know that one of the strongest predictors of resilience is social support.
In what way? Social support? Friends or just being around other people in general, like the prayer services and that kind of a thing?
Yes, humans are social animals, as we know. And it's kind of interesting, even though we don't come together, it seems like after bad things happen, people do come together. And I joked with my students that after 9/11, the New Yorkers, who, you know, we're not considered the most patient people in the world, people were very polite, letting people come out of gas stations, stopping car and waving people into the traffic. And that lasted for a long time here, about a week.
are college students particularly vulnerable?
I think in some ways they could be. One of them is to avoid being isolated. And the other is that because you have such a large community there, you don't really know a lot about the individuals. You know, in a school, for example, you have a kind of handle on the students in the school, some of their backgrounds. You also can control messages. You can control the kind of services kids are getting. But you have people who live off campus, people who are commuting, people from other countries, so it varies. However, most college campuses, and I'm sure Ohio State is one of them, has a great deal of services available to students. So the important thing is that people with a prior history of trauma are more likely to be affected than individuals that haven't, or individuals that have witnessed this directly. There's something about the vision that seems to be more upsetting than almost any other modality, except maybe smell.
I also think about the people who were sort of cowering in darkened rooms with hopefully locked doors when they were told to you know, seek, shelter in place, hide, be quiet, you know, that whole thing. What that kind of does to a person when they're sitting there waiting maybe for something bad to happen.
Yeah, I really don't want to comment on how they handle their messaging. Each university does different kinds of training and helps the students expect a message. I know we have an alert system on our campus that comes out and gives you sort of immediate responses. We once had a threat where someone said they were going to shoot some students on campus, and that went out, and people did lock down temporarily. But for the most part, people are pretty resilient. And there are some things that people can do on their own. You know, I was thinking that my wife and I were talking today. We teach kids all kinds of skills, but what we don't teach them is about the autonomic nervous system and the entire idea of fight or flight.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the vast majority of things that have upset us that are lasting are as a result of the fight, flight, and freeze reaction of the sympathetic nervous system. And so there are plenty of videos online that help people understand how to breathe. And I wear a Fitbit, and I demonstrate in class that if I do deep inhalation and then exhale twice the length that I inhaled, you can watch my heart rate decline. And so there's some simple things people can do. But the other certainly is you have a counseling center on campus. Mm-hmm. People have friends. And so as much as possible, being able to talk about, you know, their experience. We learned a while back that involving everyone, including people who weren't directly affected, is often a mistake.
Hmm. Why?
Because what you do, you know, it's you spread a contagion effect that's not necessary. Many students will, you know, have heard about it, looked at it, but moved on.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is Dr. J. Barry Mascari. He's a professor of counselor education at Keene University and an author. He's co-editor of the book Terrorism, Trauma, and Tragedies, A Counselor's Guide to Preparing and Responding. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. And Sharon in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Sharon.
Good morning. Of course, I was watching with everybody else yesterday and, you know, in the middle of the, oh, my God, God help us, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
The first conference that happened in front of OSU, I was listening to everybody talk, and the medical director was saying, you know, we've practiced for this, we have good cooperation with the other hospitals. And I said to myself, you most certainly have and you most certainly do. I'm a leadership volunteer with Franklin County Columbus Medical Reserve Corps.
Mm-hmm.
And after 9/11, one of the things they found out was that there were a lot of people out there who were qualified to help, who wanted to help, but there was no way of credentialing them. So after 9/11, out of Homeland Security, they created the Citizens Corps, and it's administered at the local county level. And if people want to be involved and help the hospitals prepare and help the localities prepare and be there to help out in situations even like flu shot clinics, get on the web and check out the Franklin County Medical Reserve Corps. You don't have to be a doctor.
Okay.
You don't have to be a nurse. Everybody can help, and heroes are not born, they are made.
Okay.
Great call.
Sharon, thank you so much. Thanks for your help. You bet.
Interesting. Sharon raised that process of volunteers. New Jersey was the first state to start the Disaster Response Crisis Counselor credential. It's now spread to various names around the country. But we're all volunteers serving, and we're deployed by county. Certainly can be deployed by the state. So the idea that people want to help, and especially in times of disaster, is a good one. And we just ask always that people not deploy themselves, but be deployed through some organization.
Does it matter that the attacker was also a student?
That's a good question. I'm sure to some students it will, or some people, but again, you know, trying to provide some perspective on this. I was at an Islamic wedding, and it was the first Islamic wedding I had been to, even though we have a number of observant Muslim students. And the imam discussed the idea of fear, and so I think, if anything, one of the caring responses would be to reach out to the community, and certainly let them know, because I think it spreads beyond him being a student. I mean, if he was just the American-born citizen, it might have a different meaning. But the imam was discussing how the Islamic community is nervous, and people are concerned about practicing their faith openly.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, one of the things that struck me is that, and I said this to one of the family members there, I said, you know what, we're more alike than we are different. And the imam could have been a Catholic priest or a rabbi or a minister and change a word or two, and it would be the same expressions. And I think people tend to rise to the occasion and do want to do something to help. I know a friend of ours did the response at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Connecticut, and they had so many donations of stuffed animals that they had to get a warehouse because people want to do things. People want to donate blood. And so I would encourage people who are feeling the sense of maybe loss or confusion to try and make something out of this, to do something to help people's lives be better. It is Giving Tuesday.
Hmm. That's right. We're going to post. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah, I was just going to say, on the title of the book, by the way, there's a new title. It'll be out in March, and it's called Disaster Mental Health Counseling, A Guide to Preparing and Responding.
Why the change?
It reflects the growth in the field and the professionalization.
We are going to post contact information for students and staff who seek counseling. That'll be on our website at wosu.org/allsides. Dr. Mascari, do people who need it most necessarily seek it, though?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, sometimes people, you know, I would think college students are more aware, but many people are not aware that they could use someone to talk with and to normalize what they're experiencing. And so I think if the message gets out, that's a good one, that being upset, you know, is a natural response, and that people who are experiencing things down the road, a couple of weeks later having flashbacks, having dreams about this, or can't stop thinking about it, definitely need to see someone. And there are some very simple techniques that can be done to help adjust to this, and they're all based again on the autonomic nervous system. There's a great book out there by Sapolsky called Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers, and it explains how animals actually recover from traumatic events much quicker than humans.
Because they understand at some base level that this is life?
They don't think.
Okay, they don't think about
react.
It at all.
No.
And we think about everything afterward.
We do. It's our problem is a larger cerebral cortex. You also mentioned Virginia Tech, and people might like to know that the president-elect of the American Counseling Association is Gerard Lawson, who is a counselor educator at Virginia Tech and was involved in the response following it, and also in setting up a kind of a model for universities around the country.
Is the model that's been established different for a university than it would be a community at large?
Probably not. Universities are unique places in that they're like a microcosm community.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have the potential for people coming in and out of campus, and that was one of the issues that Gerard actually has a chapter in our book about this. Some of the early warning signals that campuses can do that maybe communities can't do as easily.
Such as?
But, Knowing when someone appears troubled.
Okay.
So, you know, and I read a little bit in the paper and saw in the news the idea of, you know, we're talking about terrorism and radicalization. And from a mental health perspective, I try to avoid, you know, the use of any of those terms, because in the end, they don't explain necessarily what happens, and they don't help people necessarily adjust better or worse to an event.
You mentioned earlier the attacker was Muslim. It's likely that other Muslim students will fear retaliation. What about their fears? Do you see the counseling centers and so forth welcoming them as well?
Of course. The counseling centers, I mean, that's one of the hallmarks of all of the mental health professions, and that is to be non-judgmental and to treat all humans with the same respect and dignity, regardless of who they are.
How the administration responds matters. You know, for example, what if the university erects cement barriers between the street and the courtyard where the attacker drove his car into the crowd yesterday? Are such barriers comforting or not, these kind of physical manifestations of our fears?
I'm not certain that I could answer that with any great understanding, but the fact is that, I mean, we've all seen streets blocked. We've
nowadays, yeah.
Yeah, it's not uncommon. And so, you know, I wouldn't be too concerned about that.
Mm-hmm.
But there may be people. One of the phenomena that developed probably 20 years ago or so is this idea of spontaneous memorials.
Mm.
And that's kind of interesting. You'll see it along roadsides where there are accidents.
Yeah.
Or after, you know, shootings or things. And so, who knows, that may be an expression that will come up as well. I know Virginia Tech had actually a wall where people put up messages and placed flowers. And, of course, theirs was a much larger scale incident.
We want to know why he did this. It's natural to want to know what motivated such an attack. Can knowing help?
Help the rest of us. Well, my guess is probably not.
Okay.
For the most part, a lot of things people do don't really make sense. You know, I think back to the bullying incident at Rutgers, where the roommate videotaped a relationship with, I'm blanking on the student's name now, who ended up killing himself.
But
the fact was, I mean, why did he do something that ridiculous? I mean, who knows? And it really doesn't make the situation any better. So I think we turn to each other and talk about not what we can do to at this incident, but what we can do moving forward to reach out to each other. Because you know, like it or not, we're all on the planet together, and we're more similar than different. And I think the more compassion we express toward people, the more we also help ourselves recover.
Dr. Barry Mascari, thanks so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you, and thanks for doing such a great public service.
You're welcome. Dr. J. Barry Mascari, an associate professor of counselor education at Keene University and co-editor of the book Terrorism, Trauma, and Tragedies, A Counselor's Guide to Preparing and Responding. A new edition is coming out with a new name this spring. Maybe we'll talk about that then. Coming up, we're going to talk about the criminology of such an act, what we know about why these things happen. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking today about the attack on the Ohio State campus Monday. The attacker drove a car into a crowd outside a classroom building and then exited the car with a butcher knife and proceeded to slash and stab onlookers. 11 victims were hospitalized with a range of injuries, and a campus police officer shot and killed the attacker. Such attacks on college campuses are not new. University of Alabama criminal justice professor Adam Lankford studies such incidents. His 2013 book is entitled The Myth of Martyrdom, What Really Drives Suicide Bombers, Rampage Shooters, and Other Self-Destructive Killers. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, nice to speak with you.
The attacker in this case did not kill himself. He ran from police. Does that appear suicidal to you?
Well, you know, I think it fits with the pattern. In other words, another case where you know, people ask about the suicidality is the Fort Hood shooting. You know, and I've spoken with people who investigated that case from the FBI and stuff, and they found that the Fort Hood shooter, you know, despite being suicidal, that we now know, and he admitted it after he was shot and paralyzed, in the moment, you know, some of that self-preservation kicked in. So he was shooting at people and then ducking behind cement walls to dodge bullets and then shooting again, despite the fact that, you know, he was seeking a so-called martyr's death. So my guess is that, you know, this guy knew that this attack would end in his death with all probability, and certainly he, you know, passed up the opportunity to surrender. So, you know, I still think, you know, chances are we'll find out that this guy had, you know, significant mental health problems, or at the very least was kind of pushed to the edge, suffering with some sort of despair.
You build a case in your book that terrorists are driven to suicidal actions for the same reasons anyone might be. So what's the parallel there, that they have something else to, you know, to wrap themselves in the process?
Right. Well, you know, naturally the focus of a lot of these investigations by the FBI after an incident like this is whether the individual, first of all, had connections to a terrorist organization, and then whether the individual had, you know, what we'd consider some sort of terrorist motives, was inspired by a terrorist organization or a cause like that. And I think there's some initial indications that this guy, at the very least, you know, did kind of have a political agenda that he claims. What I've shown in my book is that that's largely a cover. You know, it's a way that people like this rationalize their actions as justified, but when you start paralleling them with, for example, other mass stabbers or other mass shooters, other people who commit murder-suicide, and sometimes even other people who just kill themselves, you see a lot of parallels in terms of their life struggles, their sense of hopelessness, perceived victimization, sometimes, you know, depression, other mental health problems. So, you know, underneath it all, you know, the real reason this guy did it was not, you know, I would say it was not political, because, you know, a lot of people have political criticisms of the government, and, you know, what makes them different is that they care about surviving.
Huh, okay. Does someone in his position, someone like him, what about that whole lone wolf thing? What's the significance of that? And a lot of people have been very critical about using that kind of description in these sorts of cases.
Right. Well, I mean, I think, you know, lone wolf can, as a phrase, you know, can kind of glamorize these individuals, which we certainly do not want to do. But if you just think about them as lone offenders, behaviorally, not, you know, participating or collaborating with anyone else, you know, I think, first of all, basic common sense suggests that, you know, someone who really cares about a cause typically recognizes that they can accomplish more for that cause by reaching out to others. You know, you can always accomplish more as a group than you can as one lone individual. So the fact that, you know, he didn't reach out to other, you know, ideologues, terrorists, people like that, as far as we know, would kind of question the logic behind the attack. And then the other thing is, often these people are socially isolated, so sometimes it's, you know, a lack of social connection that actually fuels their despair. And kind of more broadly socially, you know, within the last year, a report came out that says basically suicides in the United States are at a 30-year high.
Yeah.
So I would look at, you know, social isolation and people who are desperate on their own in that context.
30-year high. What was going on 30 years ago? Is there anything to draw in terms of a parallel like that?
Well, that's a good question, you know. I can't really say, you know, it's kind of like the economy or crime rates. You know, when you talk about big social trends, it's hard to say why suicide rates are higher than they used to be. But, you know, one, I guess, concerning thing is that as a society, there does seem to be more social isolation, you know, and to some degree that may be enabled by technology. So, you know, people who are kind of disconnected, you know, living by themselves or their social lives are essentially only online. You know, I think there are a lot of people who now sit on their computer screen and see what's out there and see what they're missing in a way that's kind of profoundly disappointing and raises their sense that they're never going to fit in.
The attacker who was eventually killed really within a minute of the attack on campus yesterday had also, according to NBC News, posted on his Facebook page frustration about not knowing, you know, about, you know, being a Muslim on campus, being misunderstood, having the United States misunderstand and its whole relationship with the rest of the Muslim world being misunderstood. Again, you're saying that's just sort of a cover. It's some way he's trying to make sense of how he's feeling inside?
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't think the political part of that is really, you know, explains why he did this. Obviously, there are, you know, many hundreds of thousands of Muslims in this country. And, you know, like a lot of us, you know, people across different races and ethnicities, you know, they may have some concerns about feeling misunderstood and things like that. But of mm-hmm. course, most of them are nonviolent. So, you know, I don't think it's his identity per se that led him to do this, but I'm sure those feelings of fear of persecution, probably did play a role in his behavior. And I guess the parallel I would make is with, you know, other school shooters, other terrorists, especially those who intentionally die in their attacks. This theme of feeling like you're misunderstood, like you're not going to be treated fairly, is a very common theme, and it's, you know, common for white attackers, it's common for black attackers, it's common for Asian attackers. So, so it is an underlying theme that often kind of justifies the violence because these people think, well, you know, if I'm not going to get a fair shake, then, you know, I'm going to lash back against the people who either don't respect me or I can't count on to treat me fairly.
What is your sense about what to expect in terms of copycatters in a case like this?
Well, that's a major concern, and that is something I've been looking into. You know, when you look at this individual, and I'm sure there'll be investigations in terms of, you know, computer forensics, digital forensics, and tracking what, for example, this guy's been looking on online. But you wonder about potential influences for him. So was he, for example, influenced by the truck attack in Nice, France? Was he influenced by this September 2016 Minnesota mall stabbing that was committed by a Somali American and injured 10? You know, what were this guy's influences, and will he influence anyone else? And, you know, as far as that goes, I guess, you know, I have a few thoughts. One is that I have done a study which shows that sometimes these things are clustered. In other words, sometimes you have a few attacks within a few weeks or a month. And when I looked at an 8-year span, it showed that sometimes that just happens at random. Mm-hmm. Just like sometimes it happens that it rains more in certain weeks or months than others. On the other hand, you know, the inspiring of future copycats is a real problem. And, you know, I clicked on a news video of this guy earlier today. And at first I was very happy because I saw this guy's head, and then I saw a big blue box across his face. And I thought, well, geez, maybe the media is hiding this guy's face in an effort to discourage copycats. And then I clicked on it, and it was just the play button. So the box disappeared, and we showed this guy He showed his identity. You know, his name's obviously been all over the place. So I do find those things concerning in terms of the potential to inspire copycats who also want their names and faces everywhere in the media.
Yeah. Is that typical? I mean, is it necessarily that guy wanted that? I don't know. I just get a different feeling about this guy. I'm not quite sure why.
Right. Well, very reasonable question. Now, of course, you know, it appears that he was posting online, you know, and whether that was kind of to leave a leg, you know, the FBI calls these legacy tokens.
Okay.
Whether he was posting that to leave a legacy or he's kind of just venting, you know, I guess we don't know yet. And then the other thing is, you know, I guess I have some questions, and maybe this is kind of what you're picking up on, is how premeditated was this attack, really? You know, sometimes these attacks are planned for weeks or months or even years, and, you know, they're very specifically designed to get fame and attention. You know, other times there's a much shorter planning period, and the fact that he didn't use guns or explosives or anything like that, you know, would suggest that maybe this was a little more spontaneous, a little less planned, and thus, you know, he may not have thought deeply about getting attention the way that some of these attackers, like the Orlando shooter, for example, did.
In the title of your book, The Myth of Martyrdom, the subtitle says, "What really drives suicide bombers, rampage shooters, and other self-destructive killers." Self-destructive killers being the key phrase there. How do you... is it simply that they want to kill themselves in the process, or what?
Well, there's a lot of variation. So, you know, typically we have kind of in an incident like this, you know, if it's attempted murder-suicide, you know, which is, you know, sometimes complicated by the idea of, like, attempted martyrdom, you know, because... some of these people wouldn't claim they're doing suicide, even though they intend to die. But so, you know, when you have these two motives, to kill and to die, certainly one can be more powerful than the other. So, you know, with some of these attackers, we see that they're the most important thing to them is to kill as many victims as possible. And then they just kind of expect they will die. In other cases, they don't really care about how many they're going to kill. And they're using this act of violence as a way of framing themselves as heroes who will die for the cause. In other words, their primary motive is to die. So you see that balance. There's a lot of variation. Of course, you know, I've studied this around the world, and that brings in all sorts of other elements of this as well, because you have, you know, outside of the United States, you have some of these attacks which are essentially coerced because the sponsoring organization puts pressure on the individual to do this, or he or she will face punishment. Or the family will be punished. We don't have that in the United States yet, fortunately. But it just shows kind of how complex the problem is worldwide.
Right. That dynamic doesn't exist here yet. Is that the big difference between the United States and the rest of the world?
Well, you know, there's certainly a variety of differences. That's a big difference. In other words, when you have organizations, well, for example, you know, ISIS kidnaps children and forces them to commit suicide bombings. Boko Haram has done the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you have people committing suicide attacks who aren't really even doing it voluntarily, that certainly raises the threat to a new level. But we also have, you know, cross-national differences in terms of firearms availability. We have other differences in terms of the presence of organizations, and we have differences in terms of, you know, what percentage of people support these attacks. You know, in Palestine, you know, a lot of people think that this kind of thing would be justified. In the United States, far fewer do, which is why I think, you know, we tend to have less of these.
Adam Langford, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Sure, thank you.
Adam Langford, criminal justice professor at the University of Alabama and author of the book, The Myth of Martyrdom, What Really Drives Suicide Bombers, Rampage Shooters, and Other Self-Destructive Killers. Thank you so much for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.